Notes from America is supported by Future Hindsight, an award-winning podcast that shares big ideas about participating in American democracy, beyond voting, but short of running for office. Join host Mila Atmos for stimulating and incisive conversations with citizen changemakers on topics ranging from gerrymandering, policing equity, and voting rights. In this election year, Future Hindsight offers an unaffiliated perspective into what's at stake and how citizens can make an impact at the local, state, and national level. You'll always come away with something hopeful. Tune in every Thursday to get engaged and stay engaged.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
I'm Kai Wright, and this is the United States of Anxiety, a show about the unfinished business of our history and its grip on our future.
We have students coming into the buildings. What would have happened on September 10th now happens on September 21st.
One of my customers told me yesterday, you're more important than a lawyer right now. No one needs a lawyer. Everyone needs to come in the grocery store.
Let us not forget for a moment that thousands of those workers have made the ultimate sacrifice in serving their fellow Americans.
We have been at the forefront of the pandemic as essential workers while we were caring for others. Who was caring for us?
This was the sound of New York City in the spring, clapping and pots and pans banging in celebration of what we've come to call essential workers. A sonic release from the unsettling quiet of a city totally shut down. By summer, the sound of our lives became protest and rage. And now, as summer winds down, there's an odd sense of normalcy, at least here in New York. But we're wondering, will we go back? Back to that old, creepy quiet of a shutdown city? Back to the nightly celebration of those who, once again, might have to risk their lives so society doesn't totally collapse? If so, we'll be facing some really hard choices about all of that essential labor. Already this past week, New York City narrowly avoided a teacher strike. We actually just kicked it down the road a couple of weeks. And the labor dispute kind of boils down to whether educators, and everybody who works in a school for that matter, whether they're willing to risk their lives while doing their jobs, and whether the rest of us will force them to do so. This is really just the beginning. In this episode of our show, we're going to talk about two particular kinds of essential labor and the questions they raise. First, we'll consider the public workers who make cities function, people like those teachers. And then, a little later in the show, we'll talk with the people who literally take care of us in our families. So let's start with public workers. I have personally been thinking a lot about New York in the late 1970s, which was our last really intense fiscal crisis. So earlier this week, I called up a labor historian at the City University of New York, Joshua Freeman, and I asked him for perspective on the budget crunch we're facing today.
You know, the mayor has threatened 22,000 layoffs, which is getting pretty close to the number of layoffs in the first couple of years of the fiscal crisis. So, you know, if that really happens, then we're talking about one of the worst cutbacks in public employment in the city's history.
If you know New York's history, I mean, just the words fiscal crisis can be an emotional trigger. So to think that the city is now considering anything like the number of layoffs as the late 1970s, that is scary.
You felt it in the everyday life of the city. You know, literally, garbage wasn't being collected. The subways weren't being maintained. Doors were opening between stations. You know, basic public services were simply not being delivered. Kids showed up for school in September, and the classes were, you know, 40 kids in a class. The few years after 1975 were very, very rough years for day-to-day existence in the city.
Talk to me about, like, the way we think about city workers and the history of that. My, you know, so I've been in the city for about 20 years. You know, it feels like even in that time, we've been through so many different sort of public attitudes about city workers, you know?
I think the public has a kind of two-sided view of public workers. I mean, on one hand, they're often very appreciative. A lot of bus drivers are beloved by their regular customers. I think a lot of older New Yorkers who use the bus, you know, develop relationships with particular drivers. So, you know, I think there are certain workers that provide services that make a real everyday difference in people's lives who are the beloved ones. But, you know, also public workers are the face of a system that doesn't work for a lot of people. And therefore, they are often the subject of a great deal of abuse and anger and resentment. Sometimes resentment because the subway doesn't work or it's overcrowded or the air conditioner's broke and people take it out on the conductor. But sometimes resentment because they have steady jobs and they're getting pensions and they're getting health insurance and lots of hardworking New Yorkers aren't.
So here's the question. As we move into what is by any measure going to be a hard year for New York City and a lot of cities, frankly, how much do we value each of these public jobs? Which ones are we prepared to cut? Which ones are we prepared to force into work, even if it's for less compensation or in less safe conditions? As our team thought about these questions, we considered one particular city workforce as a sort of case study. Reporter Jenny Casas looked into the history of the people we used to call garbage men.
You might go your whole life without ever needing to call a fire department. And you might go your whole life without ever needing to call a cop. But you need a sanitation worker every single day.
Okay, Kai, so I talked to Robin Nagel, who is the Department of Sanitation's official anthropologist.
And anthropologist? I had no idea the Department of Sanitation has an anthropologist. That's kind of cool.
Totally. And you can tell a lot about who we are and how we live by our trash. It's such intimate work. Like, the sanitation workers who run the same route all the time can tell you so much about the people that live on those blocks.
Oof.
Who's getting married? Who's getting divorced? Who started drinking again? Who's beating up their wife? Who's left their husband? Those kinds of really intimate details about a home, they can read it in the trash.
What's the story with trash in New York City right now? I mean, I would assume with all of these people who have left town to move wherever it is they moved, that we have less trash.
You would think that, right? But it turns out that because people are staying at home, or a lot of people are staying at home more, and we're all like surrounded by all of our things, and we're throwing out stuff in our homes, and we're ordering more online, there's actually a lot more household trash and recycling.
What, if anything, has the department been doing to help protect them from COVID amidst all this?
Right. So the department has given out everyone masks and hand sanitizer. Mm-hmm. And every shift when a truck pulls in, there's a team of people ready to sanitize and disinfect the equipment. So like the steering wheels and the front.
Uh-huh.
But even so, since the pandemic, over 650 sanitation workers have tested positive for COVID-19.
Oh, wow.
And at least 8 have passed away as a result of the virus. Maybe the best way to appreciate their work is to understand it a little better. And the best person to fill you in on that is one Harry Nespoli.
I took all of the city tests, took the police, took fire, took sanitation, and I said to myself, the first one that calls me, I'm going to take. And the first one to call me was sanitation. So I started the job in 1970.
His first day on the truck, he's with two veterans on the job. And their first stop was at this park.
And they had these wire baskets. So I take the pail and I throw it into the hopper, what's inside the pail. It hits the hopper. It splashes back in my face.
Oof.
And what is it? It's all dead pigeons and blood.
Harry had no words.
I said, What is that to get?
He'd always fancied himself a tough guy.
I grew up in Brooklyn, you know, when it was Brooklyn.
But this was too much.
I went home that night. I told my wife, it's the God's honest truth. I said, babe, listen to me. I ain't going to make 20 years on this job.
Harry is now the current president of Local 831, the Sanitation Workers Union. So what brought him back day after day after day for 50 years and counting? It was the steady paycheck, a pension, a full suite of benefits, healthcare, medical, dental, glasses, prescriptions. Today, sanitation workers have unlimited sick leave, and depending on when they start, they can retire after 20 years on the job with 50% of their salary for the rest of their lives. One worker described it to me as, quote, the best security blanket you can go to sleep with every night. And all those gains can be traced back to the founder and first president of Local 831, John J. DeLory.
Good evening. Few local questions agitate our city more violently than the problem of public employees and their rights. Our guest this evening on campus press conference is a man who must wrestle daily with problems like these.
I have been the first union in the city of New York that has been granted...
John DeLory spent a fortune, our founder, to do one thing. And you know what it was? With public relations. What do you think it was? You're going to be quizzed on this. What do you think it was?
The fire department and police department has a certain amount of glamour to it. A cop can be killed by trying to apprehend a criminal, so it makes front page news. A fireman can be injured out of a four-alarm fire, screaming headlines in the paper. A sanitation man sweeping the street can be killed by a motorist coming down running into him, and you don't even find three words in the paper.
DeLory built a whole legacy on demanding that the Department of Sanitation not be treated like the ugly stepchild of the city's uniformed forces.
The word garbage man, that's a curse. He made it sanitation. That's the word it should be.
Workers at this time were constantly being injured. They had no sick pay, no overtime, terrible working hours, and small pensions. In 1965, a sanitation worker was found crushed to death in the back of his truck's compactor.
The sanitation man is subsidizing other city workers because sanitation men can never enjoy the benefits of the pension system they're in now.
In this interview from the WNYC archives, DeLory cites that the average sanitation worker doesn't even make 16 years on the job.
Because the life expectancy is shorter than the expectancy of the rest of the people that are in that system.
And after that death in 1965, DeLory threatened to strike, but didn't follow through. And it was on his mind in 1968 when contract negotiations fell apart. Now, New York State had just passed the Taylor Law, making it illegal for city workers to strike. That law is still in effect today. But at the time, the union was demanding more pay and pension benefits, and the city would not budge. DeLory famously addressed 7,000 sanitation workers gathered on the steps of City Hall, yelling, "No contract, no work." 10,000 workers walked off and stayed off the job. And with that, the sanitation department would prove the worth of their work by not doing it.
It don't affect me except for the very bad smell here. It's terrific. It's
starting to affect my business where customers can't get in here because of the garbage situation.
You can't go down no one avenue without seeing nothing but garbage and rats.
I would like to see some.
Day after stinking day, the trash continued to pile up.
Every moment that goes by, the situation gets more serious. There's 10,000 tons of garbage that are left on the streets every day. We're up to over 100,000 tons now.
In a word, New York is a mess, all because of this degrading, unconscionable, and unlawful strike.
A few days into the strike, the Board of Health had to declare a state of emergency. Hospitals couldn't discard their medical waste, and a number of fires were going up across the city because people were burning their trash.
I've been in this country for 50 years, and I never see nothing like it. It's really terrible. It's a mess.
A week passed, and still, no deal.
The only progress we can report is that the negotiators have gone through three rounds of soft drinks, and the newsmen waiting in this press room that's almost as littered now as the streets outside have gone through four coffee urns and four dozen delicatessen sandwiches.
John DeLore was arrested and jailed for defying a court order. The mayor called for the support of the National Guard, and eventually, Governor Rockefeller stepped in and took over the negotiations without the mayor's blessing.
The concept of using military forces for strike-breaking purposes is one that is alien and completely an anathema to all organized labor. I think I ought to say very frankly that you can't move garbage with bayonets.
New Yorkers had either learned a new appreciation for sanitation, or they had learned to fear its absence.
Anyway, long story short, the strike ended.
Here's former sanitation worker Anthony Lofaso, remembering his first day back on the job.
And we resumed on a Saturday night to pick up. And at least in my neighborhood where I worked, in the South Bronx, when we came on the street, the people were clapping in the street. That's the kind of support that we had. And throughout my career, I tried to impress on the sanitation workers that the best ally we have is the public.
There'll be nothing that will be able to take the place, no machine that I can visualize, that can go over to the building of the house, pick up the can, bring it out to the curb over three or four parked cars, dump it in the thing, and then bring it back to the house. Now, this may come, but this would be utopia, and I don't think I'm going to be around to see this kind of a day.
Well, thank you very much, Mr. DeLore.
John DeLore would pass away less than 2 years into his retirement in 1980. When he started his career with the sanitation department as a dump laborer in 1936, he was making less than $1,800 a year. By the time of his death, New York sanitation workers were some of the highest paid in the country.
Where we put our money is into the people who provide service to New Yorkers.
Now, New York City is facing a financial crisis.
Sanitation workers, education.
And balancing the budget means that cutting the city's workforce is on the table. And Mayor de Blasio has been talking for months about laying off up to 22,000 people.
If you got to keep cutting and keep cutting, it has to at some point reach personnel. It's just pure logic of budgets, and it's very sad logic. I don't like it one bit, and I want to avert this at all costs. So.
Nespoli.
Hi, Mr. Nespoli. This is Jenny Casas.
Hey, Jenny.
Thank you so much. Harry will be the one negotiating to keep those layoffs far away from his workforce.
This workforce came to work, caught the virus, was isolated, stayed home, and some of the families caught the virus, and then they came back to work.
Harry himself had the virus back in March. Both he and his wife were very ill for weeks.
Could you imagine that garbage laying out in the street in this summer that we've had with heat? Forget about it. It's crazy. It's really, the world is turned upside down right now.
One more note about public work. It's been a particularly important road to the middle class for Black families here in New York and everywhere. And that means the economic fallout from the pandemic might hit Black communities just as acutely as the virus itself did. Coming up, though, the story of another workforce that has been uniquely important for people of color, particularly women of color. I'll talk with Ai-Jin Poo, who helped create the National Domestic Workers Alliance. And if you do care work of any kind, home care work or domestic work, I want to hear from you as well. Call us up at 646-435-7280 or tweet us using the hashtag US of Anxiety. It's coming up after the break. Do you ever feel like there's nothing new in the news? You know, like there are urgent things happening in the world, but all you hear is noise. That's where What Next comes in, a daily news show we love from Slate. They tell you the stories you haven't heard before or a different side to the stories you thought you already knew. Join host Mary Harris every day as she cuts through the noise so that together we can all figure out what next. Follow and listen wherever you get your podcasts. It's Labor Day weekend, and that means this week we're talking about essential work and how we actually value that work. Home health aides and personal care aides have long been the fastest growing jobs in our economy. And the Bureau of Labor Statistics estimates they will remain the fastest growing jobs over the next decade. So it's these workers, really, not those in the manufacturing or farming sectors. It's these workers who are arguably the forgotten people of the American economy. They are overwhelmingly women, particularly Black women, and quite often immigrants. They're also one of the most poorly paid, least protected workforces in the economy. But, and this is important, they are also at the center of what is probably the most energized, growing labor movement in decades. So, if you do any form of care work or domestic work, I want to hear from you. I'm interested in your own relationship to the work. What brought you into it? Was it just a financial choice? Like it was just, that's the work you could find? Or was there something else? And then what keeps you in the work now? What do you value in it? Particularly now that it can be quite dangerous to do what you do. What sustains you? Tweet us at the hashtag US of Anxiety. And joining me now is Ai-Jin Poo, who has helped build a national movement of domestic and care workers. She's the co-founder of the National Domestic Workers Alliance and also of Caring Across Generations, which is a network of advocacy groups trying to transform how we handle long-term care. Ai-Jin, hi, thanks for joining us.
Hi, Kai. It's really great to talk to you. Thanks for having me.
It's a pleasure. And so, Ai-Jin, also, you are the co-host of a podcast called Sunstorm with Alicia Garza, who is, of course, famous as one of the co-founders of the Black Lives Matter movement. And you guys are launching your second season this week, right?
That's right. We're really excited about the second season. The whole idea of the show Sunstorm, we launched it after the 2016 elections because we really felt, I don't know if you've experienced this weather pattern where you have sometimes a torrential rainstorm and somehow miraculously the sun is still shining through.
Yeah.
And after the 2016 elections, we were just reflecting on how this country is experiencing a sunstorm, a political sunstorm, where we have these unprecedented threats and attacks on our democracy and the kind of fabric of our society and our culture. And at the same time, we have courageous people of all walks of life stepping up to march, to vote, to run for office, to protect our health care and to move us forward. And so that was the inspiration for the launch of the pod. And the second season is focused on finding your lane. So really figuring out a way to contribute to bringing the country closer to its promise in a way that feels authentic to you. So we're really excited about it. First episode features the one and only Megan Rapinoe. So we hope that folks will tune in.
All right. Well, I mean, the way you talk about the sunstorm idea, this, you know, that there's these, the sun shining through an otherwise torrential downpour is honestly a lot of how I think about the domestic workers movement that you've been part of over the last, you know, decade plus. So I want to talk about that. And can we just back up and talk a little bit about your personal relationship to that work and that movement in the first place? What originally brought you to this, to this space of building power amongst domestic workers, people who work in other people's homes, essentially?
Well, I was raised by my mom and my grandmother, two really strong women who I just thought walked on water and could do anything. And, you know, they did everything in the household. They went to work and they were really engaged in the community. And I had hundreds of aunties who all were part of a caregiving community for me and my sister. And I think that there was a disconnect for me between the way that I saw women powering everything in my life. And I just assumed as a child that if women are powering everything and making everything happen, that of course they would be in charge and making all the decisions. And I quickly realized growing up that that was not the case, that women are not really in positions of power and decision making, and in fact, overly concentrated in positions of vulnerability and abuse. And that disconnect just kind of played out over the course of my life and got me really interested in working with women who are powering and holding up our families and our economy, and yet don't have basic recognition, even the recognition that the work of caring is real work. We still refer to it as help, right? Yeah. And meanwhile, there are millions of professionals whose work makes everything else possible in our families and in our economy, and wanting to really address that incredible disconnect became something that just was more and more meaningful for me.
Yeah. Can you tell us about some of the history here? Because, you know, you mentioned that we don't even think of it as work. So many people, we refer to it as the help. There's a very particular history to that too, right? That, you know, this is yep. work that was very explicitly carved out of labor law. Can you give us some of that background?
Sure. So as we all know, domestic workers are more than 90% women and majority women of color. And the work itself of caring and cleaning is often associated with women culturally and kind of assumed that women will take care of. And then as a profession, domestic work has always been associated with women of color and Black women in particular. Some of the first domestic workers in the United States were enslaved Black women, as a matter of fact. And that legacy of slavery has shaped the conditions and the way that this workforce has been treated, both culturally and in law and policy. And a big defining moment was in the 1930s, during the New Deal negotiations coming out of the Depression, Congress was debating what would become our foundational labor laws, the National Labor Relations Act, which gave workers the right to form a union and collectively bargain, and the Fair Labor Standards Act, which established the minimum wage laws, the protection and the right to a minimum wage and overtime pay. And Southern members of Congress refused to support those two measures if they included protections for farm workers and domestic workers specifically. And at the time, they were Black workers, and it was an explicit expression of anti-Black racism and a refusal to allow for Black workers to have equal protections under the law and to be able to, frankly, build power as workers. And so that exclusion has really shaped the conditions of domestic work for generations to this day. And it has also been a place that domestic workers have resisted and organized and built power for generations. And we stand on the shoulders of giants, Black women like Dorothy Lee Bolden, who founded the National Domestic Workers Union in the 1970s and organized Black women throughout the South to improve wages and working conditions. And our work is very much carrying forward her legacy and trying to bring dignity, respect, protections to this work that really is such a core part of what makes this economy work and also a large share of the jobs of the future.
I want to talk more about all of the organizing past and present here in a minute. But first, you know, within all of that history that you just described, you also, as I gather, your family has some experience with care workers that has also sort of shaped your understanding of long-term care and how we provide that. I wonder if you can tell me about that experience.
Absolutely. So, I mean, I think care is an issue that really does connect us all. I think all of us, the former First Lady Rosalynn Carter famously said, there's only four kinds of people in the world, people who need care or will need care, and people who provide care or will. And in my case, my grandfather, my paternal grandfather, he actually lived a long and for the most part, very healthy life. But when he was in his 90s, his vision started to deteriorate and he started to lose his other functions quickly. And we weren't able to find appropriate home care for him. So he was placed in a nursing home against his wishes. And I visited him in that nursing home and it broke my heart in a thousand ways. He was afraid. He was sharing a room with half a dozen other people, some of whom were wailing and suffering and pain, and the other of whom were just completely comatose and unmoving. And someone who lived with such dignity and strength, to see him in a state where he wasn't eating and was in a deep, deep depression and actually passed away after just a couple of months in that facility. It was so heartbreaking to me that we couldn't offer him a more dignified form of care in his final days. And then on the flip side of that, my grandmother on my mother's side, she also lived a very long life and was able to live independently for her entire life in the comfort of her own home because she was supported by wonderful home care workers over the course of 15 years who enabled her to go to church and participate, even singing in the church choir, enabled her to keep playing mahjong. She was a mahjong shark. Let me win once a year on my birthday.
Got to give them hope.
Exactly. Got to keep me coming back. And she was really very independent up until she had a stroke, and the whole time was able to have a dignified quality of life because of the support of home care workers. And I will forever be indebted to the women who supported her over the years, because there is no greater gift than that quality of life that good care provides.
And these are just a tale of two systems, essentially, that you took away from that.
Exactly, that we have a system that is patchwork at best, and that actually doesn't help families prepare for the inevitable care that they need. We've never really invested in our caregiving infrastructure or systems or workforce. The average annual income of a home care worker in the United States is $16,000 per year. Wow. And imagine trying to survive on $16,000 per year, let alone raise a family. It's an unsustainable wage, and as a result, we lose many of our best caregivers to other low-wage service jobs like retail and fast food. And about 800,000 people are on wait lists waiting for home care through the Medicaid program. We just don't have the system in place that we need to support a dignified quality of life for older adults or people with disabilities who want to live at home independently, which they deserve. And so we need to, and I know that, you know, nursing homes are always going to be necessary, and there's a whole movement to transform nursing homes and to make them much more home-like in terms of a context to age, and there's great work being done there, but we need choices, and our elders and our loved ones with disabilities deserve to have the choice to live at home and connected to our communities, and we just don't have that in place. And with such a large and growing older population in this country, it's long overdue, and I think the COVID crisis has really brought that into focus.
And I just don't want that $16,000 a year number to slide by people. You know, it's such, I think everyone agrees how essential this can be. We've seen how essential this can be under COVID, as you pointed out. We're all going to need it in some form. And we're talking about something that we valued as a society at $16,000 a year. And this sort of returns to our question in this episode with essential labor. What are we prepared to value it? How much are we really willing to put as a society behind the things we consider essential? But let's take some calls. I'm talking with Ai-Jin Poo, who is the co-founder of the National Domestic Workers Alliance, an advocate for the lives of women of color who do so much of the so-called essential work of our economy. And let's hear from Dr. D. Unterich in Crown Heights, I believe. Are you there?
Well, hi. Are you there?
Yes. First off, have I said your name correct, Dr. Unterich? Is that
close
correct?
Close enough. Unterbach is the last name, but
okay,
Dr.
I'm
D
sorry.
Is fine.
Dr. D.
And my family is originally Crown Heights, going back to, I think, 1904. I'm now relocated. I headed north to Connecticut. But
okay.
First, let me thank you. I did a
1992, I did a dissertation on unionized home care workers at 1199. Sorry, I'm catching my breath. I was coming upstairs. And shout out to 1199, who created a closer living wage. From a philosophical perspective, this is clearly a feminist issue. All poor women being helped by, as you pointed out, younger, often immigrant women raising children alone frequently and sending money back when they do to their home countries. It's also an issue of economic justice, that this work is not valued. It is also very isolating because you're working with a single, often single old person without the legal and social support that I think retail at least offers.
Right.
But the larger issue, it seems to me, is creating a career ladder. Home attendants are at the bottom of the rung, then home health aide, then CNA. And how to incentivize, how to provide scholarships so people can get the training to become an LPN. There is such a need for nurses. And the last thing is, we need to expand, I believe, the kinship care model, where people get paid for taking care of their family, older people, quite like we have kinship foster care, where grandma takes care of the little ones when mom is not well.
Dr. D, I'm going to let you go now, but thank you for calling. I want to hear from you, Ajin, a little more about that kind of model. Dr. D, one of our callers, was saying we need new models, essentially. We need new models for these kinds of workers in order for it to be an economically viable job. And I want to just put that to you. I know that is a big part of what NDWA has been doing. What are some of the new models that have been coming out of your organizing?
Great question. Especially just thinking about New York. 10 years ago, New York became the first state in the country to pass a domestic workers' bill of rights. It was a 7-year campaign that thousands of domestic workers were a part of that was historic and broke new ground in terms of protecting the rights of domestic workers. And since then, 9 states and 2 cities have passed similar legislation. And Senator Kamala Harris and Representative Pramila Jayapal have introduced a federal domestic worker bill of rights to really not only address the longstanding exclusions and protections that we talked about, but really create a new framework for rights and a voice for this workforce, including establishing what we call a standards board, where we can bring workers and employers and government together to talk about what should be the standards and norms that shape conditions for this workforce. And I think that's the kind of thing that we need to be moving towards, is I think that our economy, similar to our democracy, suffers from just such a unsustainable and toxic inequality. And we need to put more power in the hands of more everyday people, especially working people, especially essential workers and women of color, who power so much of our economy and have done so much to keep us safe in this pandemic, to give them a voice and a seat at the table in defining our economic recovery and the way forward and what should be the standards and protections. I mean, just thinking about the home care workers who've been working through this pandemic, they are the only lifeline in many cases for some of the people who are most vulnerable to the virus itself, older people, people with disabilities, people with chronic illnesses. They've been the only human contact, bringing medication, bringing food, and we rely on them for and so I mean, much. And yet, yeah.
That dynamic that you're describing also, you know, I mean, this the isolation inside that dynamic, there's this the employers, many of us don't consider ourselves employers who have domestic workers or care workers in our home. And yet it's this one-on-one relationship. Can you talk about how that impacts things, this you know, the ways in which the person doing the hiring and the person doing the work have this oddly intimate relationship?
It is incredibly intimate, and it's very unique in that most people don't consider or would never think of their homes as workplaces, right? But they really are. They're workplaces for millions of workers who provide care and cleaning services for us. And it's also unique in that you could go into any apartment building or any neighborhood in New York and not know which homes are also workplaces. Mm. There's no sign, no registry, no list. And so setting standards and making sure that the workforce has protections is both a matter of policy and it's a matter of culture. How we really see and treat this workforce, how we value them, each and every one of us as individuals and as households, is really, really important.
Let's go to Pauline in Rockland County. Pauline, hello. Welcome to WNYC.
Hi, Kai.
Hi, how are you?
I'm doing okay. How are you?
I'm wonderful. And so I gather that you have done care work for about a decade.
Yes.
Tell me about it. When did you start and why? What brought you to it?
Well, my family and I, we moved to Rockland County about 10 years ago for my husband's work. And I was looking for work as well. And I noticed that there was a lot of elderly people in my community, and neighbors were saying that they needed help, etc. And so I thought I would get certified and get into it from the bottom up, so to speak. I wasn't expecting to stay in it as long as I have, but it has been really, really wonderful. It's been amazing to be able to help people. You go home feeling good about life, I think. At least I do.
And do you feel like your work is valued financially by society? Some of the things we've been talking about in the hour in terms of having job protection.
Financially, no. When I started, people in my agency were making $8 an hour. Now, with all of the different minimum wage increases, we're making some more than that. But still, I feel like because I also do private, and private, you're expected to be paid a lot higher. Yeah. So I feel like the people who work in the agencies really should be paid more. Mm. It's not high enough, I don't think.
But you value your work and it's rewarding, and that's
oh, definitely. It's extremely important. I mean, just where I am, there are so many different senior centers, senior complexes, people who are struggling to take care of family. And not everybody, of course, is going to be able to be paid by Medicare. If you are a certain, if you get caught in the middle, like you're not, I guess, poor enough, or you're not rich enough, you're kind of like in the middle, you don't get any help at all. And that group, they may be able to pay for a few hours, but they can't get all of what they need.
I'm going to let you go, Pauline. Thanks for calling, and I hope you'll call us back. Ijen, as we start to run out of time here, I just quickly, if there's something that Pauline said that jumped out at you, what was it?
Well, it's such an amazing thing that I witness every day, how dedicated our care workers are and how challenging the work is. And despite not having the financial, the compensation that they deserve, they continue doing the work. And it's so powerful, and it's really time that we valued this work differently and also protected it.
So later tonight, you're going to be part of what I gather will be a Labor Day weekend tribute to essential workers.
That's right. So
tell people what that is and how they can participate.
Yes. So this is a Labor Day like none other, as we're all still in the midst of a pandemic that rages on, and our essential workers, all so many industries, grocery workers, delivery workers, sanitation workers, domestic workers, are all still working and still don't have the protections that they deserve. And so this tribute tonight, which will air at 8 p.m. at honoressentialworkers.com, will be an opportunity for us to honor our essential workers and to take action to make sure that they have the protections that they deserve. We have been applauding them, and they deserve that applause, and they deserve so much more. They deserve an essential workers' bill of rights. They deserve access to health care and better wages. And so we hope you'll join us for this tribute and also join in the effort to support essential worker protections.
That's at honoressentialworkers.com.
Honoressentialworkers.com at 8 okay. p.m. tonight.
Great. Well, Ijen, thank you so much for joining us. You've got a lot happening, and honestly, just your energy for all of that you do is an inspiration in and of itself. So thank you.
Thank you so much. I love your show, and thank you for bringing in the voices of care workers.
Ijen Poo is the co-founder of the National Domestic Workers Alliance and Caring Across Generations. And thanks to all of you for joining us tonight as well. And the last thing I'll ask you to tell me is, what have you been cooking out there? We have learned that as folks listen to the show, because of the hour we're in, that a lot of you are out there fixing up food. So I want to know what you're doing. Send me pictures of it. Send me recipes of it, whatever you want, to Kai_right, or use the on Twitter, or use the hashtag US of Anxiety. My boyfriend is in there making tomatillo sauce right now. So that is what I am about to go grease on. And so I hope you got something good coming too. This is the United States of Anxiety. I'm Kai Wright. And if you're just finding the show, check out our podcast feed for tons of previous stories and conversations. There's lots and lots of content there for you to back up and listen to, wrestling again with what it really means for us to live together in a multiracial society, what it's going to demand of all of us, what we'll have to endure in order to bring it about and bring about the joy that'll come from it. So I hope I will talk to you again next Sunday here live at 6 p.m. And, you know, thanks for spending this time together with us. Happy Labor Day, everybody. The United States of Anxiety is a production of WNYC Studios. This episode was reported and produced by Jenny Casas and Carolyn Adams. It was edited by Karen Frohman, who is also our executive producer. Engineering help from Ed Haber, Matthew Mirando, and Jared Paul. Kevin Bristow was at the board for the live show. Our team also includes Emily Botine, Marianne McCune, Christopher Wirth, and Vera Lynn Williams. And a special thanks to Andy Lancet and the WNYC Archives for all that great historical tape from sanitation workers. Our theme music was written by Hannes Brown and performed by the Outer Borough Brass Band. Keep in touch. You can follow me on Twitter at Kai_Wright. And thanks for listening. I hope if you can, you'll join us next week live Sunday, 6 p.m. Eastern. You can stream it on WNYC.org or tell your smart speaker to play WNYC. Take care of yourselves.